course. I don't know why is it called review? So you're supposed to know quantum gravity, and we are just going to review that. No. So the idea is that I will give you an introduction to quantum gravity, and this course will be also focused very much on something which I call quantum geometry. And quantum gravity, is a vast subject with loads of different approaches. So I will tell you about one particular approach and also focus mostly of most part of the course on actually 3D quantum gravity, because that is very nice and very suitable for an introduction, and it saves us for lots of boring calculations, so that will be a bit nicer. And yeah, so first I will try to busily explain you a bit what quantum gravity is about and why it's quantum geometry. But so to take that as a disclaimer, so because of the time, I cannot explain you every possible approach to quantum gravity which is out there, because there are many, and everyone is actually requires kind of different mathematical knowledge and so on. So there's some nice common subjects which I will mention. So there are many conceptual issues which are common to all the approaches, and we will discuss these. And so I will give you kind of a more subjective view. And it's a bit based on concepts in loop quantum gravity and spin foams, because these are very geometrical. And the other advantage is it's actually what we are going to do, especially since we are going to do 3D stuff. It's very much related to actually topological phases. So basically, we're doing an advanced course in topological phases, which you might have encountered in condensed matter theory or quantum information. And the techniques are also a bit similar, but quite different from Young-Mills theory, as we will see. So it's not completely different from standard physics. So here I've given you a bit of reading material if you need that. So there is basically an almost finished script by me, and I guess we will kind of distribute it or parts of it tomorrow, I hope. And yeah, so mostly I think in the script there will be also lots of additional material, because my experience is that I don't really manage to cover all this material in the script. And lots of these details of calculations in case I don't manage them. So here you have these literature sources. So this book, I guess it should be there in several copies in the library, because it was supposed to be bought last year, but I didn't check. So it's very basic. If you want to have a very gentle introduction, it starts actually with special relativity and so on. So lots of stuff you should know. Then there's a bit more advanced material, which is a bit older, but also quite focused on 3D and maybe a bit on 4D by Alejandro Perez. You can just find that on archive. And then there's a thick book by Thomas Thiemann. And you might not be able to really read it through during this course, but and there's a version, I think there should be still the lecture note version on archive. So if you just look to it, I forgot the exact title, but it's kind of an introduction to modern canonical general relativity, if I'm not too wrong. And there's also a shorter version. So maybe the shorter version of these lecture notes are just 100 pages, and they're also on archive. But mostly I will basically follow my own script, very surprisingly. And so I'm not going to follow any of these books, if you're wondering. So let's basically try to see, what do we What do we need to do to actually understand quantum gravity, which we haven't understood at all so far, or to a big extent, but there's still lots of things to understand. And the challenging thing about it's a bit different from standard physics in the sense that what you want to do is you put quantum theory, you have quantum theory, and we know that so far all these forces which are connected to what we usually call matter are basically described with quantum theory, except that we don't know what dark matter is and all these puzzles, but anyway. And then we have gravity, which we take to be described by, so it's not equal, by general relativity. To our hero physicist. Alberto Einstein. And in particular, the one lesson of Einstein was that actually general relativity or gravity is a property of space-time geometry. So basically, here we have space-time. Geometry. And what you want to do if you want to construct, kind of a unified field theory, which brings, say, the gravity, if you want to see it as a force together with these other forces, or even if you just want to consistently couple all these quantum matter fields with gravity, you want actually to quantize gravity, which means that you actually need to quantize space-time. And so this is basically the big challenge. So if you think about it, standard quantum mechanics or quantum standard quantum quantum field theory always takes the notion of space and time to be granted. So you usually have basically a quantum field theory on a fixed space-time. And quite often it's just flat quantum field theory. Of course, you can also take curved quantum field theory, but it's a big difference to actually do, how did I call it? A quantum theory of space and time. And the question is, what does it mean? And so apart from lots of technical challenges, there are actually lots of conceptual challenges of to make sense out of a quantum theory of space and time. And in a sense, time is a more difficult concept there. Okay, and here's just one concept. I don't know. Let's try with that. I was wrong. Okay. This is the first one, I think. Ah, it's not the first. Okay, so I just it's now up there. I not just say that. One concept which comes in is basically the concept of background independence. So quite often background actually, background is not specified, so people can understand whatever on their background. But in this context, background is often understood as a space-time background. So it's a choice of often geometry, like Minkowski space or Anti-de Sitter or de Sitter space. And so typically in standard quantum field theory on curved space-time, you base everything on this background. And background independence means that you don't prefer any of these backgrounds. So you want to treat all these space times on equal footing. And on equal footing is already very badly defined because it basically means that you have to think how to specify a measure which makes these things like on equal footing, and that is not easily defined, as we will see basically. So that is basically what background independence means to some subset of people. And this is one challenge, you know. And assume you have actually solved this challenge and you have your nice theory of quantum gravity. Typically, what that means is you have your theory, which describes, you know, your fundamental quantum gravity. But the second challenge is that you have to show that there is some limit in which you get back standard physics. And so this is another big challenge, which almost all approaches still have to manage. And the reason is that you basically have to bridge a huge amount of scales, namely basically the Planck scales, so 10 to the 41 things. because your theory describes, you know, you usually understand it as describing quantum gravity, which is supposed to explain new phenomena at Planck scale, and you want to show that you regain our world at larger scales. And so it's a bit similar to condensed matter, but a bit harder, because in condensed matter, again, you actually have a space and a time, and for instance, you know what an atom means or what, you know, a field in space-time means. However, if you basically have atoms of space-time, in a sense, you cannot really describe it as an atom of space-time sitting somewhere, you know, because it doesn't sit somewhere, because it's space-time itself. So these are one of these conceptual challenges, which in particular come out in the canonical approach. And we will actually go quite a bit through this canonical approach. And in the canonical approach, it has a bit of an advantage that it typically offers a clearer understanding of these conceptual issues, except for quantum gravity in a sense. And it emphasizes actually these notions of observables. And indeed, one completely open question, or one quite open question, in a sense, is to have a good notion of what is observable in quantum gravity. You know, how do we make, what does it mean to make a quantum gravity measurement? And again, the typical problem is that, you know, what does it mean to make a measurement at some time? So this is not well defined in even classical GR, and less so in quantum gravity. Okay, so since I had some trials last year, I can actually offer you an overview of this course, at least to some part. So we will actually start with really a classical part. And mostly I hope that some part of this classical part you have already seen, but I guess we actually go through it again. And so I go through the action, the variation of this action and symmetries. And then we consider something which is called a first order action. And I hope you have seen that. So actually I'm So how many of you have taken Roux course and know what a tetrads and spin connection is? Okay, most of you. So I might be quite fast on this part. So this is the first order action. So that would be tetrads or in 3D triads. And spin connection. And the reason we are doing this is that this action is much simpler to analyze. It's almost will be almost trivial if you compare it later, for instance, with the discussion of the ADM formalism, for instance, in this last book. You will be really thankful for this first order action, at least in 3D, because we will basically see that it's almost a free, actually, you know, it describes basically almost a free theory. It looks quite simple. Okay. And then we go through the canonical part. So I'm not sure how much Roos has discussed that. So canonical part, EDM, no? Okay, so she hasn't. So the canonical analysis of an action is quite important if you want to do canonical quantization, as you can guess from the names. And it will tell us basically what are actually the degrees of freedom in our theory and what are the initial values. And here there's one important part which typically you might encounter the first time. Also, I find it's a very important concept, namely, you know, gauge symmetries, which comes also there. And gravity is mostly about actually diffeomorphism symmetry, so it's a very important concept in this point. And these gauge symmetries always lead to so-called first class to constraints. And the canonical description. And so we have to basically, you know, we have this phase space of constraints. And I guess, yeah, if you have seen that, tell me because I can save lots of time. But this typically you encounter first in gravity, but actually it's the same in Young-Mills theory or any other system with gauge symmetries. Okay. And then we will have the quantum part. And here, since I introduced the spoke of these constraints, so we will actually discuss. So most of you know how to quantize a normal phase space in a sense. So here we discuss quantization of gauge systems or systems with constraints. And then we come to quantum geometry. And in this context of 3D gravity, we can nicely describe it as quantization of geometric objects, namely of edges, triangles, and tetrahedra. And as will be clear, then edges, quantizing edges and triangles gives you, in a sense, the quantum kinematics, and the tetrahedra give you the dynamics. And once we have done that, we can actually write the wave function of the universe. It's a toy universe because it's in 3D and Euclidean. And that's basically how far I came last year. And maybe we are faster this year. So depending on time, I can try to explain you that the path integral quantization, usually you can often hear, unfortunately, that path integral quantization is much better than canonical quantization, because path integral is much more covariant or something. It's a bit nonsense because path integral is usually derived from the canonical approach. And indeed, I will just, the main point is actually to show that this gives you the same result as canonical quantization. And you could have also started with the path integral quantization. So it's more a question of taste and maybe interpretation. And yeah, then there's the question whether I managed to tell you some more stuff about 4D, which are mostly technical issues and all the difficulties you have to encounter and solve in 4D. Okay, so let's try something. Okay, I guess I switch to the side here. Oop. So actually, this is an overview. So now basically we start with part one. And as this is overview, I actually want to start with actions. So are there any questions to this overview? Overview questions. Okay. So I guess you all know the concept of an action. It's basically quite important if you want to quantize things. Also, there's basically, to mention all possibilities, of course, there are approaches which don't use actions for quantizing. But as you will see, the action basically tells us lots of things because typically it includes all the variables you have to think about. But it's a bit subtle. All the variables doesn't really equal to all the degrees of freedom. So there's a concept which is basically called gauge symmetries, or which are a bit different from global symmetries of an action. And then there's another thing, as you might have heard, different actions might describe you the same physics. So I will start to discuss the Einstein-Hilbert action. But mostly we will work with the first order action. And I was a bit lying. So in this case, you hope actually they describe the same physics, and they do so almost in the classical terms. But actually, there's a big question in the quantum theory whether they describe the same physics due to some subtleties. As you will see, there are lots of subtleties in quantum gravity. So let's start with. Like I just write you because I assume you have seen that the Einstein-Hilbert action, and it comes with some constant which is dimension dependent, and I'm not sure I will have consistently this constant, but indeed I will set it to one. So kappa 4D. And yeah, I hope you have seen this. So this is a Ricci scalar. And this is symmetric. And let's be always already a bit general here. So mostly, I guess you have seen that 4D equal to 4, but in fact, you can write this for any dimension. And D equal to 2 is a bit boring for classically, because this turns out to be actually basically a constant in 2D. On 2D surfaces, it's a related to the Euler characteristic. And in d equal to 3, it makes quite sense, but we will also see that d equal to 3 is quite special. So given an action, what do you do as a physicist? Indeed. So one important thing is you have to make your mind up what are actually the basic variables in this action. And here it's a so-called metric tensor. And it actually doesn't make a big difference if you take basically the metric tensor itself as your basic variable, or you can alternatively vary with respect to the inverse metric. It's a bit simpler to vary with respect to the inverse metric. So a priori, this metric tensor will be our basic variable. You probably encountered the notion of diffeomorphic symmetry. As you know, very different looking metrics can describe you the same geometry. And indeed, we will basically, that is this basic concept that we will see that this notion of symmetry and the notion of geometry is quite different from just having this metric tensor. But let's go on and vary this metric. So I put kappa to 1, and to first order, we just write this. I hope I can. So this is one term. But of course, we shouldn't forget about this term. And I've seen this. So let's actually be already a bit more explicit. We write here the Ricci tensor, and we get the Ricci scalar by contracting this G menu. Square root of G plus, this was the other term, and so here we have the usual rule that this is given by the variation of the Ricci tensor contracted with G menu plus R menu times the variation of the inverse metric. Okay. And basically, I hope you have seen this trick. Otherwise, you might have to read it in the notes. But last year, I've seen that Ruth actually discussed it. So the nice thing about this variation is actually that this term gives you a boundary term. And it's quite important because otherwise, you might have gotten higher derivatives because R in principle contains second time derivatives. And if you vary, you might have gotten something with third time derivatives. But it turns out that this term, which basically could have led to higher derivatives, is a boundary term. So that means actually that this variation, in addition, it's basically the most complicated term to derive, so it's good that it vanishes. This variation gives you a so-called total divergence. A total divergence means this. It's this divergence, this nulla applied to a in this case, one form. And working out this, you could do in detail, going through, you know, the Ricci tensor is a nice exercise. But indeed, there's a nice trick, which are called the Palatini equations. Palatini equations. And that basically uses that you can derive this variation in a special coordinate system, which are called Riemann coordinates, and you get basically to this result. So this is quite nice, because if you have an integral over a divergence, and this integral is on a manifold without boundary, this just vanishes. It also tells you that you have to be a bit careful in case you have a boundary, then you have to discuss boundary terms. And we will not do that in this course, but it's a nice subject. So we have only to worry about some other things. So we only have to worry now what the you know, basically we already have this delta G mu is basically the variation of delta G mu inverse is basically already our basic variation which we need. So we have only to care about the variation of this thing, which just applying basic rules of differentiation is the variation. This will give us a variation of the determinant itself. So G, of course, denotes the determinant of G mu. And again, there's a nice identity, which you can prove, and which I think Ruth should have shown to you, which gives you this variation of the determinant of the matrix. Thanks. Basically, it turns out if you if you vary the if you take any derivative of a determinant, then something like the trace appears. And in this case, in terms of the variation of the matrix itself, you get this result. And you can remember that, you know, this is basically the trace, and then you need this factor of G just to get the right density. Have you discussed densities? You always just say no. Whatever I ask him. Okay, so later on we will mention the concept of densities, which is nothing else than tensors multiplied with some determinants of your matrix. I hope so that it's okay. So here you have this, and if you have never seen this, there's also some trick to relate basically the variation of G mu with the inverse. And this trick, it actually, you know, you should know it in general. So basically you use it. This should be equal to Kronecker delta. And so this is zero. And so you write this out. And then you basically can always relate the variation of any matrix with a variation of your inverse matrix. And in some cases, it gives you important minus signs. So this explains the minus sign here. Okay, so we have these two terms. Now I vanish behind this funny thing here, so you can't read it. So we need just to put this together. So these three terms, we have seen that this thing vanishes. We still have this thing. And so the last term gives us minus 1/2. So we basically get R mu nu minus 1/2 R from there, G mu nu here. And then we have basically our basic variation. And all this is integrated over d-dimensional spacetime. I forgot, yeah, there should be somewhere said that, somebody said that, somebody is very good. It's the square root of g missing in my script, actually. Okay. And there you have the Einstein equations. Okay, well, this is usually called the Einstein tensor, which we don't really need. And so we have always these nice looking equations which tell you something is equal to zero. And so if you are in a vacuum, it's actually equivalent to a Ricci tensor being equal to zero. Okay, and as you have seen, so maybe you discuss it only for d equal to 4, but it makes complete sense in any dimension. And so in principle, you know, all higher dimensions, but also for d equal to 3. And so we basically consider, you know, what does it mean to have Ricci tensor, Ricci tensor being equal to 3, to 0, in 3D. And here you have something which does not apply to 4D, because otherwise the, you know, 4D would be bit more boring as it is. It implies that actually the Riemann tensor is equal to 0. So 3D gravity without matter cosmological constant is locally flat. And so how can you actually deduce it? You can actually count the number of independent degrees of freedoms in both objects in dimension 3. And you will count the same number of degrees of freedom in these two objects. And the point is that this Riemann tensor has to satisfy so many symmetries that it basically reduces to the Ricci tensor. And so here it's basically, it has to be antisymmetric. In the first two and last two indices. So it's symmetric if you exchange this pair with this pair. So let's write this. And then furthermore, this thing actually vanishes. And so in particular from here, these two, you know, this is an antisymmetric pair and this is an antisymmetric pair. And in 3D, they run from, for instance, from 1 to 3. And you might know the usual trick basically by introducing an epsilon that you can summarize an antisymmetric pair. No, I have this one. I don't know. I can check. But I have this one. But I check. Okay. Because the Bianchi identity is usually it's with the differential. So this doesn't use the Bianchi identity. It's a differential identity. That's so. And so you summarize this into another index sigma, and it just means, you know, that there is basically only three antisymmetric combinations of two indices which run from 1 to 3, like 1, 2, 2, 3, and 1, 3. and you see that you actually only deal with an object which has two indices, which is basically this Ricci tensor. And this Ricci tensor has to be symmetric. And this basically is included here. OK, so actually, yeah. This is automatically satisfied. OK, so we have that's locally flat. It doesn't mean that you have just one solution because geometry always has two, I mean, has always local aspects, but they are global aspects. And these global aspects are usually summarized into something called topological degrees of freedom. And so that's why 3D gravity is called a topological field theory. And as we will see, it basically means that you start with a field theory, you know, because you have a field which is given by the metric. But you end up with a theory which actually has only finitely many so-called physical degrees of freedom, and in some cases it even has zero physical degrees of freedom. And you know, by now there's lots of famous examples which are actually all very similar to the 3D case, these so-called topological faces. And why does this happen? As we will also later discuss, this reduction of degrees of freedom happens because all these field degrees of freedom are actually gauge degrees of freedom. So indeed in 3D, you know, you have this metric. It's a 3 times 3 divided by symmetry. So it's basically a priori 6 degrees of freedom per space-time point. And they're basically all, they all vanish due to diffeomorphism symmetry. Okay. And to give you, you know, to tell you that maybe we are not doing completely trivial things, one example of topological degrees of freedom in this case in geometry are so-called moduli parameter. And so the easiest case is if you consider torus in 2D. And so you take a piece of paper. And you cut out a parallelogram. It's not a parallelogram here. And so since you cut out this parallelogram, it means that actually it's flat. You know. So this geometry here, it's a flat piece of paper, so it's a flat geometry. However, you take this piece of paper and you glue this piece. It's a bit difficult, but actually you can do it with some tricks. You glue this edge to this edge, and you glue this edge to this edge, and so you get what is called a torus, which on the American continent is known as a bagel or a donut. And so here you have locally flat geometry, and so you might think that there's nothing you can specify. However, there's some global geometric data, and basically these data are given by this length, which sometimes is called tau 2, and tau 1, or in other words, basically it's this vector. Tau 1 and tau 2. So here have these two moduli parameter, and indeed these things play basically the role of dynamical variables and 2+1 gravity if you have for your spatial slice torus topology. And then these things really change in time. Okay. Other questions so far? Okay. So we still have lots of time. I'm quite fast, actually. Oops. So we've gone through this Einstein-Hilbert action. I still have 10 minutes. So I can remind you of some stuff which you already know, apparently. And these are these triads and tetrads and so on. So they have like X names, tetrads, triads. Field binds, which doesn't specify the dimension, the last one. And so this will be basically of rewriting this action, the Einstein-Hilbert action. And to something, it will be actually the Palatini action. And it's a so-called first order action. And it's a common trick. No, basically what you do is you introduce more variables, and also it looks initially more complicated. It turns often out that introducing more variables gives you something simpler. And indeed we will see that this Palatini action makes it completely obvious in 3D that 3D gravity is in a sense quite a simple theory, especially that it's a topological theory. We are asked to see that here is in principle quite complicated if you wouldn't have known this trick. You know, you would have looked for all kinds of solutions satisfying R mu nu equal to zero, which is kind of looks as complicated as in 4D. And so here we do kind of this usual trick, which you of course might know, that you introduce more variables, but it typically just means that you introduce another symbol for your first derivative. And so you call it typically P. I mean, we don't call it P in our case, but that's the basic idea. And so what you hope to get is then an action which does not contain derivatives. In the usual case. Because usually you have a first order time derivatives in the action, but if you replace these by some momenta, you don't have derivatives there. And so we will replace our matrix so in this case, if you do that x point x dot replacing by p, then you basically have two set of variables x and p. So here we will have how do I call them? Yeah, these tetrads, triads, or field binds. And we will have a so-called spin connection. And so the spin connection will play the role of the momenta. And it has lots of indices. Apparently, it has these indices. OK. So what is a field bind? What you basically do is to introduce an orthonormal frame at each space-time point. And instead of using basically the matrix as your basic variables, you use these field binds, and you have basically the You have these field binds as your basic objects and need to express the metric as a function of your field binds. So in this case, you have a so-called internal index I, which in our case then goes from 1 to 3 in 3D. And mu is a space-time index. And so also normality. Means that if you have these vectors and take basically now just the metric product, basically is a norm product between these two vectors because you use basically the metric to pull down one of these indices. And of course, we follow the usual convention. That this is written with an index down. And so this is defined to be delta ij. So again, I use a Euclidean signature in case I have Minkowski signature. I would need to write here just the Minkowski metric, eta ij. And so basically, as you can see, we can already pull down or pull up this index mu. So you can also pull up the internal index. And so basically, you do that with the internal metric, and the internal metric is just this Kronecker delta. And so here you have the space-time metric, and here you have the inverse of the Kronecker delta, which conveniently is the Kronecker delta. And so these things, by construction, will in some sense be really inverse to these things. And if these are called triads, then these things are called co-triads. And you need the Koch triads to express now the metric as a function of your triads. Okay. So in principle, you can use this equation. Now you have your metric. As you can guess, if you want to write the inverse metric, you pull up these indices. And you could use this equation to put in your Einstein action, and then you would get your action as a function of the triads. And however, that's not what we are going to do, because we really want to use this trick at some point, and that will be the introduction of the spin connection next time. And so if you would do just the first thing, you nevertheless would have the problem. Basically, you introduced more degrees of freedom because these are really nine. things, where symmetric is just 3. However, as you can already see, is that the different choices of this choice of triad, so of triad. So if you rotate this triad around with an SO3 rotation, even an O3 rotation, you get the same metric. Because this O3, you know, leaves this the Kronecker delta invariant. And so we will get, in addition to diffeomorphism symmetry, we will get another gauge symmetry, SO3. And then typically one goes to the covering group SO2. And so this in the end will result in a thing that we can formulate gravity as a SU2 gauge theory. And that is what is done, you know, actually also in Trans-Simons gravity, if you have heard about it in 3D, but also in our approach, BF, which is very much related to Trans-Simons gravity. And so that's the reason why these things have much in common, I mean, some things in common, like the basic variables, with Young-Mills theory. So it's basically, we formulate everything as a gauge theory, and then gauge here just means with respect to this internal rotations, SO3. So we will go a bit through SU2 quite later on and discuss lots of things which you might have encountered, but maybe not so much. And this Francois David actually about Young-Mills theory and SU2 and these things. So we will actually become experts in SU2. So we have this gauge symmetry. In addition, we will have the diffeomorphism symmetry. And next time, I will basically introduce the spin connection. And in the end, we will see that basically the action expressed in the spin connection and in these triad variables is extremely simple. Okay, so I close here. If there's any questions? No. Let me know. And we see each other, I think it's tomorrow, at the same time.